Timothy, I just think you do a phenomenal job. I mean, you really are really listening to what I'm saying, and you're really finding the connections and kind of weaving everything together to really have a more powerful message for your audience. And I'll be honest, you actually helped me learn about myself through this as well. So no, it was a very powerful conversation with you. Thank you.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. Guess what? We're doing a part two of innovation in the social sector. We've got Emily Baxter here for a second conversation because we are all criminals. One in four people has a criminal record. Four in four have a criminal history. There's a lot to talk about regarding that concept. It will blow your mind as you once you purchase her book and kind of get into the message of it. Emily Baxter is the founder and executive director of We Are All Criminals. She has served as the director of advocacy and public policy at the Council on Crime and Justice in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and as an assistant public defender at the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, where she represented indigent members of the Leech Lake and White Earth bands of Ojibwe charged with crimes in state court. Emily is a former fellow at the University of Minnesota Law School's Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. She began developing WeAreAllCriminals.org through a Bush Fellowship in 2012. WeAreAllCriminals.org is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that seeks to inspire empathy and ignite social change through personal stories of crime, privilege, justice, and injustice, disrupting the barriers that separate us. We envision a more just and equitable world where each of us is able to transcend our past and reach our full potential. So, Emily, your book by the same title is about who gets arrested and convicted and why. The We Are All Criminals books will open your eyes to different areas of privilege and will help you see that it could simply be the kind of day an officer has or straight up racism that could ruin a person's life. We are all criminals. And the people telling their stories in her book either didn't get caught participating in the criminal activity they described, or they just got a slap on the wrist. So I'm recommending that everyone reads this, and we would like to talk in a little bit more depth about how to develop empathy for those who are accused or caught and incarcerated, and also awaken an aspect that you might not have thought about when it comes to race and justice and our history and the criminal justice system and all the different movements that are going on in our country right now. So welcome to the program again, Emily.
Thanks for having me, Nancy.
Yeah. All right. So your organization and book are so timely and dovetailing a national awakening of our history in acknowledging the demonizing and criminalizing of African American and other nationalities. Frontline, a PBS weekly program, has been investigating the topics of being locked up in America and policing the police. There's a PBS Frontline Dispatch podcast series about juvenile justice. Prisons as a growth industry in rural America. And there's also the Netflix documentary 13th. You also mentioned before we went on air, The House I Live In. Could you describe a little bit about what's that about?
Sure, absolutely. So the House I Live In is the title of a documentary that is now, I'm going to say, about 8 years old. And I have seen it at least 16 times.
Oh my
gosh,
wow.
This documentary is about the war on drugs, and it is so rich with stories and with facts and with heartache and heartbreak and hope. And I think that anybody who's interested in the war on drugs, anybody who's interested in criminal justice in America, anybody who's interested in delving into the particular intersection of race and justice and mass criminalization and mass incarceration in our country should watch this documentary. It has Michelle Alexander in it, the author of the outstanding book called The New Jim Crow, which I also believe should read. It has Gabor Mate in it. He talks about what drives addiction. It has Dr. Carl Hart in it, psychologist. let's just say he is brilliant, and I can't begin to pronounce his title. He's just this deeply intelligent and innovative a man, and he talks a lot about addiction and criminalization and in particular race. It is just such a rich combination of very powerful interviews with incredibly intelligent and insightful people, as well as kind of snapshots into the lives of people who are directly and immediately affected by the war. So you have people who are being sentenced under inhumane, draconian, mandatory minimum sentences, and judges who are speaking directly to the camera and saying that this is not just, this is not justice. I do not want to send this man away for 30 years for this minor offense, but my hands are tied. This is the law, and as a justice, I must follow it. It is absolutely maddening, and it's incredibly eye-opening. So I would recommend to your listeners to watch The House I Live In.
Okay. I'll have it in the show notes so they can just click on and read a little bit more about it. April 26th, also of this year, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice opened in Alabama. Hundreds of private donations were raised by citizens giving voice to the victims of racist terror. The new memorial museum is a name-by-name reckoning of injustice, a headline in the April 26th New York Times newspaper. The memorial is dedicated to the victims of American white supremacy. 4,000 people lynched are named. The New York Times images are startling, as is the 60-minute coverage where Oprah Winfrey rocks through the new memorial with founder Brian
Stevenson.
Yes, Brian Stevenson. Yep. I'm going to go make a trip down there. I mean, this is amazing. And I just feel this fits with, I don't know if you're familiar with social educator and social author of many books, Brené Brown. She focuses on shame and she's got TED Talks. I keep thinking about her Rising Strong process. And it feels like we're going through that process right now as a country, where we're reckoning with these difficult situations. We're rumbling with the depths of inadequacy and just the social injustices are coming to light in our legal system and how we're treating each other. And what part of our history is captured in our history books. And so we're rumbling with all these feelings because these things are coming up and they're bringing up some things that many of us wanted to keep hidden or pretend like, you know, it didn't affect us in the way that it has. And so the rumbling with all these different emotions and trying to figure out where the truth is, what is the truth, and what happened to all these people, and what has happened generations and generations later. Minnesota Public Radio has a whole section of a whole week of conversations that they've had with those, like a granddaughter who her grandfather was lynched. And she was describing what happened. And the journalist had done a lot of background. And he had said, well, how do you feel about him being lynched, you know, on this huge, you know, baseball field where other people were came in their Sunday outfits and kind of witnessed this? And she didn't know that. And you could just hear, I mean, how astonishing that would be to hear. And I just feel like we're all as a society having these stories that are shared and we're coming to light with things that, you know, even statues that have been monumental that have been up in, you know, and we've honored people that have been reminders of the shame that it has encompassed our whole society. And with Brené Brown, part of the revolution is to practice your critical awareness about shame and recognizing that we as a society have set up our world in such a way that we're triggered and feel awful a lot. And so the fact that all these organizations are coming together, the hashtag Me Too, the hashtag What's Next, you know, when I'm talking about Brené Brown's work, if we follow the revolutionary process that she outlined in her book, In Rising Strong, that we've been, you know, awakened, that the hashtag Me Too, hashtag Now What, hashtag Time's Up, that's the Oprah, which she had mentioned in one of her speeches, hashtag March for Our Lives. I started a Facebook page with Debbie Unterman called hashtag Truth Telling Wins. And the acknowledgement of these horrific injustices we're rumbling with, and we're, instead of these suppressed and dormant feelings that we prematurely tried to bury or wistfully thought we could move on without doing the work needed and necessary to revolutionize our country, is happening right now. So the stark images are permanently blazoned in our minds, especially of this monument. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Alabama. You can't not watch the 60 Minutes tour that Oprah brings you on and not be like astonished. Or in the New York Times, on the day it opened, they have horrific pictures giving voice to the victims of racist terror. And you've also got some things in your book. And I was just wondering, what are some of the ways that your organization is inspiring the empathy that we need, igniting the social change that we need to work together on a lot of different fronts? And how are we disrupting the barriers that are separating us? I'm hoping that because there's so many people on all different fronts addressing the criminal justice system in particular, and with Black Lives Matters, and with your book and your movement, that is creating such an awareness that those leading can help bring us forward in a way that's constructive, that creates the profound change that we're so desperately needing right now.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think that this work calls out in very clear terms that mass criminalization is a continued tool of racial control. That's something that Michelle Alexander talks about in The New Jim Crow. It's something that Bryan Stevenson talks about in Just Mercy. It's something that I certainly did not come up with, but it's something that I echo time and time and time again, that this is it's a problem in America right now, and it's been a problem in America, you know, from day one. This isn't... The criminal justice system hasn't just been used as a tool against Black Americans, but against Indigenous people as well.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the boarding schools that Native kids were sent to, and they look a lot like our juvenile detention facilities. And certainly in Minnesota, where Indigenous children are overrepresented in the juvenile justice system and Indigenous adults overrepresented in the adult justice system, you can see that continued and shameful history continue on today. So I think that the first thing we do with this work, with this project, with this book, is call out in clear terms that our system is unacceptable, and that we try to sketch just how pervasive this problem is. You know, as you said at the beginning, 1 in 4 of us has a criminal record, 4 in 4 of us have a criminal history. Why is it that 75% of the U.S. population hasn't been caught or accused? What is it that insulates people like me from being seen as a criminal? And what is it about others that just by their mere existence are seen as always already criminal? So it's an examination of race and class and privilege and punishment and second chances and mercy and first chances. And this work is also an acknowledgement that stories matter, that you need to get close. You need to understand your own story. You need to come to terms with crimes that you've committed that you haven't been caught for. You need to consider how your race and class privilege allowed you to not be viewed as a criminal, to not be caught. And then to consider the foreclosed futures of everyone who has been caught or accused, of everyone who has been labeled a criminal, of everyone who's had those doors for education and employment and you know countless other opportunities, those doors foreclosed to them. And I think that this work, this We Are All Criminals work, attempts to do all of that. So be clear that our system is unacceptable. Be clear that race and class have played an immeasurable role in our criminal justice system. And then ask people to take it upon themselves to be agents of change. So to listen to others' stories, to begin to open up your heart and your mind and your employment application to individuals who have been burdened by that criminal record, to appreciate that there isn't some sort of moral divide that separates you from an individual who has a criminal record, but rather it could be a divide, a chasm caused by race, by class, by geography, by era, by luck, by so much more than what I think in the U.S. we have been fed time and again. You know, that dichotomy of us versus them, that dichotomy of good versus bad, of criminal versus not.
Because it's all, what connects everything to is it's, you know, using a system to try to control people. But it's also, we need to recognize when we're being shamed, and we need to speak about shame and reach out. And we need to practice, like Brené Brown would say, practice courage in a culture of fear. Practice compassion in a culture of blame. Practice connection in a culture of disconnection. And create a culture of connection. And that's what I feel is important with this this movement and with the changes that we need to make, that we find a way to help people stay connected, whether we disagree or agree. But I believe that, you know, the truth is the truth. And when we feel or experience a shaming, you know, when somebody has shamed us, I think we need to address that more directly and bring it out of ourselves and talk about, this was shaming. This wasn't okay. This affected my being. I feel less about myself as a result of this experience or this exchange. And how can we reconnect? And I'm trying to do that in the moment, so, or as quickly as I can is, so that's, you know, a few suggestions too about how we can stay together while this movement moves forward and we really make the changes that we need to make in our society to make it better for everybody. Because it's challenging in particular right now, but I do believe that it's hopeful for us because there's so many people coming together to make the changes that we need together.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you read the book So You've Been Publicly Shamed by John Ronson?
No.
It's a good book. It certainly calls out a lot of what, you know, you're talking about with being publicly shamed, and how we as a society are moving toward a less forgiving place, or at least that's something that we grapple with. There's the possibility of becoming less forgiving and how we need to fight against that.
Very good. How has it been for you in starting a nonprofit?
Do you mean just in general? Or?
Yeah, and any specifics that you have. There are people who are starting nonprofits that are listening, and those who are in nonprofits. Is this something you're making a living from? She's laughing.
Yeah.
That's always the key question here.
No, you know, what I will say is that I have benefited immensely from the generosity of people from across the U.S., most definitely from people in Minnesota. So people who have shared their stories with humor and humility and openness with people who have shared their pocketbooks with us to help us keep moving forward, and with people who have shared their time and talent as well. This work is definitely the product of a community of people who have come together in ways large and small to create this with me. Now, Have I made it financially sustainable? Unfortunately, not yet. But that's something that the We Are All Criminals board is working on.
Yeah. Well, you've just started in 2014. It's not uncommon to during the third and fourth year to restructure kind of the business model to make it work.
Okay.
Because
that's good to know.
Yeah, because you've done a lot of work, so you know that the need is there. You know that it's important that this critical awareness, once you create an awareness, there needs to be some empathy around what people are experiencing. Then organizing the work in a way that you can sustain it is a business model issue that you can sort out and play around with to figure out and tinker with what will work best for you to sustain this nonprofit.
There certainly is a lot of tinkering going on. that's one thing. Having a very lean organization, we have one employee, and so because we are lean, we've been more adaptive, I think, and have been able to, as they say, fail faster. And learn from that with much greater ease and adaptability than I think an organization that is that has a larger staff.
Well, and that's critical to your success, is to fail quickly so that you can move quickly to cash flow. This has been a beautiful conversation, Emily. I'm wondering if you could close out our conversation with reading a chapter from your book.
So this is called Policing in America. Throughout many of the interviews, people recalled being dismissive, openly irritated, and at times even hostile to police when stopped or questioned. These responses might not be commendable, but they're certainly not worth getting killed for. And they weren't. None was arrested, much less tased, choked, or shot. One all too common public reaction to an officer involved death is to question why the deceased didn't comply. Why did they talk back? Why didn't they stop? Why did they resist? Oscar Grant had been celebrating New Year's Eve with friends when a fight broke out on the train. Several people, including Oscar, were detained and cuffed on the train's platform. Oscar was bound, lying on his stomach, when an officer shot him in the back. He died before sunrise. "You shot me," a witness heard him say. "I got a 4-year-old daughter." Eric Garner refused to be arrested on the accusation he was selling loose cigarettes. A swarm of officers descended upon him, wrapping their arms around his neck and forcing his face into the ground. Eric pleaded for breath 11 times. "I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe." He lost consciousness. An hour later, he died. A 25-year-old Freddie Gray was walking down the street when he briefly locked eyes with patrolling police. He began to run. The police chased him down, searched him, and found a folding knife in his pocket. Video of his arrest shows him limp, screaming in pain. By the time he arrived at the police station, he wasn't breathing. 1 week later, he died. Walter Scott was pulled over for a non-functioning third brake light. As the officer approached, Walter leapt out of the car and ran behind a building. The officer followed on foot. Moments later, 5 of the officer's 8 bullets fired hit Walter in the back. "He took my taser," said the cop. A cell phone video shows the officer calmly firing at Walter, fleeing and unarmed. Dash cam video shows that when the officer pulled Walter over, he was listening to Everlast's "What It's Like," a song about prejudice and empathy. Quote, "God forbid you ever had to walk a mile in his shoes, because then you might really know what it's like to sing the blues." Sandra Bland was stopped for failing to signal a lane change. Her subsequent refusal to put out a cigarette in her own car led to the officer aiming his taser at her and shouting, "I will light you up. Get out now." 3 days later, she was found dead in her jail cell. And then what follows, Nancy, is a story that I'd like to read if you have just a moment.
Okay.
So this is a participant, someone who got away with a crime. The title is Hiring Manager, and the crimes that he got away with were terroristic threats, manufacturing of explosive devices, and assault. He says, "My best friend Mike and I wanted to be the next Steven Spielberg. The alley and parking lot across from the town bank made a natural location for the bank robbery scene. Mike's brother had a nylon over his head and an attaché case with fake money sticking out of it. The rest of us were loaded up with masks and fake guns. Mike waved stage directions with his replica .357 BB gun. It never occurred to any of us that the pedestrians would think it was anything but kids making a film. Before we knew it, squad cars were coming at us from 4 different directions. It took half an hour for the police to stop shouting, put their guns away, and let us up off the pavement. Eventually, they let us go. They even let us finish up." This participant says, "The story isn't about the bad things I got away with. It's about being a kid and the presumption of innocence that a lot of people don't ever get. Once there's a record," he said, "every youthful misadventure adds further proof that you need more punishment." And then in a separate box on that same page, I talk about Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis and John Crawford and other black and brown men and children gunned down by police within minutes to seconds of meeting them. As I said before, it's that presumption of guilt and danger for some that is always already present. They are seen as always already criminal. So, Nancy, I would just ask that your listeners, first of all, thank you for tuning in and for listening to this, but I would ask that that your listeners consider what life would be like had they been caught. Consider what their story might be. And spend some time thinking about it. Sit by yourself and really dig deep. Think of college and high school and middle school. Think about a time when you were drunk or young or stupid or rebelling or exploring or angry or in a bad relationship or hanging out with the wrong crowd. Think of a time when no one was looking or when they really should have, when they really should have just paid you more or when it wasn't your idea anyway.
Yeah.
Think of the time that no one got hurt, so it shouldn't count, or when you gave it back anyway, or when they didn't even miss it, or when it was just once, or when everybody else was doing it, or when you felt like you had no choice. Think about what that offense was, the context, the story, the narrative that you allow yourself, and consider that that same context may have existed for someone else who was caught or accused as well. And that, that may not be an excuse, but it is an opportunity to recognize a common humanity. And then consider the privileges that allowed you to not get caught and all of the privileges that you've experienced in life moving forward, untethered to your past by a record of that particular event or events. And then move forward in your life with a curiosity and a mercy when interacting with individuals with criminal records.
That sounds good.
And move forward to end the mess that we're in. And I think that you can only do that once you place yourself in that position of considering what life would be like had you been labeled a criminal.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, do we need to, you know, what if we got away from punishment? But that's another conversation. And we got away and we put in place some natural consequences that would have a much longer, we would get a lot more mileage from it instead of a shaming system that makes us feel less human. So, thank you for all of this. There's a lot in here to think about and digest. And we will certainly carry on the journey. So thanks for being here.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I really appreciate it.
All right. The next time you're in Minneapolis, look me up.
It sounds okay. Good.
All right. See everybody next week. Thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, photographer, videographer, mon frère, my brother. We'll see everybody next week. Bye.